content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, how to have your most fulfilling vacation ever. Turning your leisure into learning offers the happiest holiday experience of all. By Arthur C. Brooks. Looking for a good vacation this year? You might choose from a number of models. For example, Instagram Adventure, in which you pick an exotic destination, pack as much as you can into every day, take a million pictures, and document everything on social media to advertise that you are as energetic in leisure as you are at work. On the opposite end of the spectrum, couch potato, which means that you fritter away your entire 2 weeks doing very little. Other popular options include endless weeks in my childhood bedroom for 20-somethings, and a whole month's pay shot at Disney because the kids whined all year for 30-somethings. One great vacation model, which harks back to the ancients, is frequently overlooked. The word for leisure in Greek is skeho. In Latin, the word is scola, from which we get school. In other words, the name for the place where we teach and learn derives from the word for leisure. One way to interpret this is that education is a recreational activity, a concept that may strike my hardworking students as counterintuitive. But a better explanation comes from the 20th century philosopher Joseph Piper, who believed that leisure is the circumstance in which we can learn the most if we understand and use it properly. If a conventional vacation models are leaving you cold, Piper's insight could provide the holiday you've been looking for. This year, consider using your time off as an opportunity to learn something wonderful. People pursue different objectives in their vacations, but no one I have ever met was seeking lower levels of positive emotion. The point is to be happier than usual, which is why a bad vacation is so frustrating. It feels like a missed opportunity to reset and make some emotional progress. To get the most contentment from your vacation, it is worthwhile to start with an understanding of basic human emotions. The negative side includes anger, sadness, fear, and disgust, which alerts us to threats and stimulate behaviors such as fight or flight to keep us safe. These are obviously not the emotions you're hoping to experience on vacation, though all bets are off if a long car ride with the kids is involved. An abundance of basic positive emotions such as joy, surprise, and anticipation is what you seek. But you shouldn't neglect another positive emotion of special importance, interest, the feeling of curiosity or fascination that captures your attention. The experience of interest is favored by evolution. It comes from learning new things, which rewarded our ancestors with more food and a greater chance at survival and reproduction. The same tendency for your Pleistocene hominin forebear to feel satisfaction after devising a novel way to catch a small animal persists in us today when we first master riding a bike or succeed at making a presentable souffle. The well-being effect from learning is not as straightforward as it is for other activities, such as eating a donut. In fact, it involves a bit of sacrifice. As scholars found in 2011, investing in an activity to raise competency can lower your moment-to-moment happiness, but can boost well-being measured over a longer time frame of hours and days. This makes perfect sense, of course. You rack your brain learning calculus, but then you bask in knowing it. In that respect, learning is like an exercise, sometimes painful in the moment, but rewarding overall. A key to maximizing satisfaction through learning is intrinsic motivation, or what the psychologist Mihal Csikszentmihalyi, who famously wrote about flow states, called autotelic learning for its own sake. Neuroscientists in 2014 used fMRI technology to show that this type of learning has to do with the brain's response to curiosity. They demonstrated high levels of activity in the midbrain and a structure known as the nucleus accumbens, which indicated an enhanced release of dopamine when study participants were highly curious about a subject. In other words, satisfying your curiosity through learning about whatever you're most interested in will give you a neurochemical payoff. But is learning identical to education? You might be tempted to extrapolate from this evidence to predict, for example, that if everybody went to college, we would have a happier society. Not so fast. One 2017 study suggests that whether high education drives happiness up or down depends on, among other things, where you live. In nations without high levels of education, many of which are considered developing countries, university education is associated with higher happiness. In countries with labor markets saturated with educated individuals, which is characteristic of greater economic development, the effect is reversed. University attendance is associated with lower happiness. One possible explanation is that for the former group, university training offers a path out of poverty. But for the latter group, much of this effect has long since been depleted. Alternatively, something about the rich world college experience may contribute to lower well-being. Suffice it to say that the sort of leisure learning the Greeks had in mind is not identical with the modern American college experience. Taken together, the research points to a clear strategy to build a great vacation. Identify something you are very interested in for its own sake and focus on it intensively. And because the task or skill should be challenging enough to increase competence, the satisfaction goal should be understood in hours and days, not in the moment-to-moment of learning. You can choose a range of ways to achieve this outcome, whether cheap and casual or expensive and formal. At one end of the scale, you can simply program your own reading curriculum. Over the next 2 weeks, you might set about carefully reading 4 books on a particular topic, or you might decide to read the entire Bible or Quran. You might also mix your media, reading a biography of J.S. Bach, for instance, while listening to 50 of his cantatas. At a more formal level, you might dedicate your vacation to taking a class. Perhaps you want to learn how to cook Punjabi cuisine, or follow one of the many massive open online courses, MOOCs for short, that are available for free, such as, random example, one about exploring the science of happiness. For a more intensive and expensive option, you might hire a teacher to give you a head start on playing the guitar or speaking Mandarin, and do that for several hours every day. Or hire a nutrition and fitness coach. You will be amazed at how much progress you can make in 2 weeks. At the most rigorous level, you might go all in and spend your vacation on a guided, silent retreat in one spiritual tradition or another. Or perhaps you could make a pilgrimage, walking in contemplation without devices or interruptions, and immersing yourself during rest periods in a wisdom literature that complements the experience. In a famous passage from The Republic, Plato advises on how to educate children in a way that will bring out their best. Quote, "Do not keep children to their studies by compulsion, but by play. That will better enable you to discern the natural capacities of each." End quote. In other words, kids will learn better if you allow them to enjoy recreation in a constructive way, rather than forcing them to study, which is more likely to stimulate rebellion. A similar principle lies behind the best model of vacation. Feeling compelled to relax and have fun is a common and counterproductive mistake. Telling yourself, "I will be refreshed and not think about work," is bound to lead in the wrong direction. Instead, employ a Platonic strategy and turn your leisure into learning. You might just have your best holiday ever. Our next article is entitled "America's Mixed Signals Economy" by Laura Kelly. The U.S. economy is actually doing pretty well. but for working people navigating mixed messages and high prices, the dominant feeling has been meh, feeling iffy. The U.S. economy adds 400,000 jobs in month, report spurs fears, declaimed the Washington Post last February. April job growth tide eased, growth eased decisively, stirring concern, the New York Times warned. By June, the Journal was warning soft landing may be threatened by consumers. You would be forgiven for assuming that the above headlines are plucked from this year's newspapers, but they're actually more than 30 years old. These were gathered and skewered in a 1989 article in the New Republic titled "The Sky is Always Falling," in which Greg Easterbrook argued that newspapers frame all economic news, even seemingly positive developments, job growth, for example, as bad news. A similar tendency appears in many of today's reports on the economy, too. To be fair, the sky does often appear to be falling, and sometimes for good reason. A lot of the recent economic news is self-evidently bad. But although inflation has been a beast, the economy is actually doing very well by some metrics. Unemployment is low. America has added jobs 31 months in a row. Consumer spending is high. Many economists and Fed officials, until recently, have been reluctant to cheer for these apparent wins, fearing that a tight labor market and strong demand would lead inflation to persist. When it comes to economic data, it seems all signs can turn out to be bad signs in retrospect. Consumers, too, have been feeling meh for some time now. In June 2022, a consumer sentiment reached its all-time historic lows since the University of Michigan began measuring it more than 50 years ago. In a New York Times Siena poll released this month, found that just 20% of Americans think the economy is good or excellent. But spirits seem to be lifting. Data from the University of Michigan surveys of consumers indicate that consumer sentiment has trended upward this summer and is now closer to the average outlook during a standard year for the U.S. economy, if still not quite there. This metric matters because when consumers feel confident, they spend more on goods and services, and in turn serve as the engine of the economy, Joanne Hugh, the director and chief economist of the University of Michigan Surveys of Consumers, told me. Americans' lukewarm feelings about the economy over the past year make sense in many ways. Inflation has been higher than it's been in decades, hitting many younger working families for the first time. And until late this spring, hourly wages have been outpaced by inflation for 2 years. Consumers feel poorer. As an economist, I would say the economy is pretty good because I'm optimistic that there is going to be further real wage growth, Darren Grant, an economist who has studied consumer confidence, told me. But he added, as a working person who has seen his purchasing power diminished by inflation, he understands why many consumers don't feel that same optimism. It's worth noting that average real wages have crept up in recent months, and many workers did see gains last year, especially those who switched jobs. Perception also plays a role in consumers' iffy views on the economy. As my colleague Ann Lowry wrote last month, consumers tend not to notice when things get better as opposed to worse. Further exacerbating negative perceptions is what she has called the wrong apartment problem, or the fact that so many people can't afford to live where they want to live, which can strengthen the sense that the economy is in a bad place. But political leanings can also color how people feel about the way things are going. Anti-Biden Americans might not be as enthusiastic to embrace Bidenomics. The information environment we live in is not conducive to fostering great vibes about, well, anything, but especially about the economy. For more than a year, a drumbeat of headlines has warned that a recession is imminent, and consumers are inundated with information, not always accurate, on social media. Nearly half of Americans said earlier this summer that they thought the country was in a recession or would be in one soon. Nearly half. The discourse around the economy is very different than it was 40-plus years ago, Hugh told me. The share of people saying they'd heard bad news about inflation was much higher over the last year than it was in the 70s and 80s when inflation was higher. Though the news environment is not necessarily the cause of recent negative feelings about the economy, she said, it likely reinforces them. The story of the economy right now is one of mixed messages and mixed reactions. Grant explained that we're in a middle zone, where people are watching some economic measures improve as wages catch up. Inflation is still not quite where the Fed wants it to be, but hovering around 3.2%, it's much lower than it was last summer, when it peaked above 9%. And in the second quarter of this year, the economy grew by 2.4%, surpassing expectations. What the economy and many economists now hope to see is a growing, but not rollicking, economy. So far, it seems that the U.S. has managed to achieve lower inflation without a ton of people losing jobs. That's legitimately good news. And, as the preliminary data show, consumers are recognizing that. The public has a pretty reasonable sense of what's going on in the economy, Grant said. We should give them some credit. Our third article is entitled, The New Old Dating Trend, by Faith Hill. Growing up in Maryland, Radha Patel didn't see anyone in her area using a matchmaker. But she was aware that in India, where her parents had emigrated from, plenty of couples were fixed up by relatives, respected elders, women in the community, trusted to intuit good pairs. For some reason, the idea of it stuck in the back of her mind. It was still lingering there in 2018 when friends, frustrated with dating apps, started asking for help finding love. I'm not a tech person, she thought. What can I do? Then she realized that she could play matchmaker. She started setting people up, and that turned into a hobby, which later that year became a business. Single to Shadi. She and many of the matchmakers she knows saw a wave of new clients in 2020 when the popular Netflix show Indian Matchmaking, which follows a professional Cupid from Mumbai, came out. The coronavirus pandemic might have contributed to the surge. Especially early on, plenty of people didn't want to go on more in-person dates than absolutely necessary. And perhaps they also realized that their time was too precious to waste by swiping fruitlessly on dating apps. According to Patel, Single to Shadi doubled its number of active clients from 2019 to 2020, and again the next year. The field still has momentum. New matchmaking companies have launched in the past few years, and the matchmakers I spoke with told me they've had an uptick in interest recently. Some dating sites have tried to take advantage of the trend, too. In 2021, Match Group, the behemoth company that owns Tinder, Hinge, and several other dating apps, introduced a feature on Match.com through which human coaches suggest two profiles a week for each member willing to pay $4.99 weekly. And earlier this year, a spin-off show hit Netflix, Jewish Matchmaking. Something about this historical tradition appears to be meshing well with contemporary society. In a time when dating apps give users an incredible amount of control over their romantic life, for some people, letting someone else take the wheel seems more and more appealing. In society, throughout time and across the world, people have turned to a third party to find a partner. In Jewish communities, for thousands of years, trusted figures such as scholars and rabbis acted as shadchan, or matchmakers. In Japan, nekodo, a middle person, was traditionally enlisted to present romantic candidates. Korean families historically visited a yongmi to ask for a pairing, and in medieval Catholic society, the village priest sometimes played a role. In all of these customs and many others, the matchmaker typically worked for the parents of the eligible young person. The families, not just the individuals, were linked. Moira Wengel, the author of Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating, told me that until at least the Industrial Revolution, marriage in many cultures was commonly about agriculture, uniting families to share farm labor, and to ensure the next generation that the work would continue. But starting around the 19th century, Wagle told me, industrialization made that kind of union less necessary for many families. Love became a more common ideal. And while matchmaking has remained popular in plenty of cultures, in many others, the search for romance became more an individual pursuit. People still had some informal help. Friends and family members might try, welcome or unwelcome, to set singles up. But then came dating apps, an especially solitary form of courtship. Not only can online dating be lonely, it can be extremely time-consuming. Combing through the apps can feel like a part-time job. In 2016, Hinge reported that only 1 in 500 swipes on the app had resulted in phone numbers being exchanged. When the company surveyed 300 of its users that same year, it discovered that 81% of them had never found a long-term relationship on any swipe-based dating app. In 2018, when the dating company Badoo surveyed 5,000 18 to 30-year-olds in the UK, it found that users spent an average of 10 hours a week on dating apps. All of that work gives daters more agency over their love life than they had in earlier eras. They don't have to wait for a serendipitous encounter or even leave the house. At the same time, at any time, they can swipe, send messages, and ask people to meet up. But that sense of control, which for many people is a blessing, can also be a burden, especially if you're talking with several suitors at once, a common situation on apps. Patel calls it DIY dating. All of the analysis and overthinking involved, what's not working, what's right, am I waiting too long between messages? Is the dude on the other end real? You have to do it all yourself. No wonder, then, that matchmakers are having a moment. Many people who can afford to outsource dating labor are eager to do so. Matchmaking services can be very costly. While some companies might promise a few matches for a few hundred dollars, many charge thousands, even hundreds of thousands, for a 6 to 12 month long membership, or for a handful of guaranteed dates. But they advertise a meticulous process in which experts methodically narrow down a large pool of candidates based on clients' interests, values, and assessments of past relationships. And people don't tend to use matchmakers unless they're looking for a long-term commitment. So clients can feel pretty confident that they're not wasting time on confusing situationships or misrepresented intentions. A matchmaker can also act as a guide through the very vulnerable process of dating. It might be appealing to trade in an algorithm for an intermediary who is warm, comforting, and human. Unlike the apps, many matchmakers give advice on what to look for in a partner, how to present oneself, when to give someone another shot, even where someone might be going wrong in relationships. I heard about this when the matchmaking company Selective Search put me in touch with their client, Connie Weaver, the chief marketing officer for a life insurance company. She told me she had been married for more than 3 decades before her husband died in 2020. When she started dating again in her late 60s, she didn't know what she wanted or how to go about finding it. She was a successful executive and people person, skilled at carrying a conversation in any business meeting. But that doesn't mean, after 35 years, she told me, that I was good at this. At Selective Search, I had someone take me by the hand and give me confidence, she said. Weaver's second match was someone she likely wouldn't have swiped right on had they been on an app. She hadn't wanted to date anyone in medicine, his field. She'd had bad experiences. But she decided to have faith in the process. You have to trust that they're going to draw out of you the real you, she said, told me. 4 months later, Weaver's still seeing him. It's new, but it feels special. I can't be happier, she told me. Everybody says that I'm glowing, and I haven't glowed for a long time. For people floundering in the dating world, the idea that experienced chemistry professionals could pick up on the qualities hidden deep within you and use them to lead you to someone you might have missed could be very enticing. But in order for matchmakers to do that, they'd probably need to read beyond what their clients tell them. Humans don't tend to be very good at deducing what we want for ourselves. Eli Finkel, a Northwestern University psychologist who studies romantic attraction, told me, in some studies, researchers have asked participants what they look for in a partner and found that their answers didn't don't predict the type of people whom they really go for. And people tend to be drawn to the same qualities anyway. If you're searching for someone who's, say, attractive, nice, and funny, you're not exactly unique. Even if matchmakers try not to take clients at their word, Finkel thinks predicting compatibility in advance is inherently an uphill battle. A whole lot of what makes us compatible with people is emergent, he told me. That is, it starts to exist after they've met. Even then, a chemistry is complex and mysterious and based partly on luck. He spitballed an example. Maybe one person on a date says they're from Arkansas, and the other says, "Oh, I went to Arkansas on this road trip, and I went to Joseph's Mother's Deli. Have you been there?" How well the evening goes might depend, in part, on the answer to that question. Because yes and no will spin conversation off in different directions. Perhaps both people have been there, and they compare notes, and that leads to laughter, to an inside joke, which feels like a spark. But love's enigma is part of matchmaker's allure. If you don't have the answers yourself, you can at least hope that someone else does. Weaver told me she sees matchmaking as both an art and a science. On the one hand, it's comforting to think that there's a compatibility code that can be cracked. On the other, we don't want romance to be too clinical, deduced purely from a couple of interviews or a detailed questionnaire. Mikhail Nastater, a Philadelphia-based matchmaker and co-host of the podcast The Yentas, told me that it's part of why people turn to her, and generally to humans rather than algorithms, for help. Some of this process is miraculous, she told me. It's a little cosmic. This is the modern approach to romance. People want efficiency, but also humanity. They want to be independent rather than relying on family, but they still want guidance. They want options rather than just choosing from whatever handful of suitors are in the area. But they don't want to spend hours sifting through them. Contemporary matchmaking sits at the fulcrum of humans' opposing impulses when it comes to love. It tries to balance modernity and tradition and outsource labor, and to give people an ally in a lonely dating world without removing their autonomy. Patel is just one of the many matchmakers trying to show customers that they can have it all. She gave her company the tagline, "Not your parents' matchmaker," and she's modernized her process. She doesn't match based on caste. She makes a point to work with people of various religions, as well as different sexual and gender orientations. Single to Shadi doesn't work with clients' parents, although Patel has another matchmaking company that's more family-oriented. And Patel tries to keep her services relatively affordable, starting at just over $100, so that younger singles can pay without involving their families. It looks a little different from the matchmaking she grew up hearing about, but it's not unrecognizable. She hasn't gotten rid of the essential perk, the gift of not needing to know exactly what you want, because you're not making decisions alone. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.